A poem called Still Life at Dusk by Rose Mary Wetotola Traumer. It happens surprisingly fast, the way your shadow leaves you. All day you've been linked by the light, but now that darkness gathers the world in a great black tide. Your shadow joins the sea of all other shadows. If you stand here long enough, you too will forget your lines and merge with the tall grass and old trees, with the crows and the flooding river. All these pieces of the world that daylight has broken into objects of singular loneliness. It happens surprisingly fast, the drawing in of your shadow. In standing in the field, you become the field. In standing in the night, you are gathered by night. Invisible birds sing to the memory of light. But then even those separate songs fade, tiny drops of ink in the infinite spilling. Still Life at Dusk by Rosemary Wetotola Traumer. All right, so welcome. Thank you for celebrating this day of Vesak with all of us, both here online and in person. So I thought what I would talk about is just some different touch points of the Buddha's life, you know, choice points he did, places of his life that, for myself, really inspire me, inspire my practice, also help give me a sense of confidence in the practice. So the first one is just his relationship to pleasure and pain. As you recall that when he was a young man growing up, he had so much pleasure around him. His parents really protected him from hardship, made sure he had beautiful things to eat, to see, to experience. And there's almost a discounting, a pushing away of what was not pleasant. And of course, that one famous day when he starts to encounter those who are suffering, those who are sick and aging and starting to reach the end of their life, all that started to bring a quality of urgency to him to find, where is there some happiness outside of conditions? Where does that exist? The heavenly messengers. And so that started him on his whole journey. But he also realized during his journey that pain on the other side of the spectrum wouldn't work either. And he was very austere. He was very strong in his practice, such as really harming himself to the point he was almost dead. You know, he would just push and push and push. One of the suttas speaks to it this way. I thought, suppose that I, clenching my teeth and pressing my tongue against the roof of my mouth, were to beat down, constrain, and crush my mind with my awareness. Just like a strong man seeking a weaker man by the head and throat or in the shoulders would beat him down, constrain, and crush him. In the same way, I beat and crushed myself. As I did so, sweat poured from my armpits, and though tireless persistence was aroused in me and unmuddled mindfulness established, my body was aroused and uncalm because of that painful exertion. then he experimented with not eating much to the point he could touch his ribs, touching my belly. I grabbed a hold of my spine as well. Just so emaciated. So at some point he realized, okay, this isn't going to work either. I'm going to die here. And then he was reflecting that being almost near to his death, that, you know, no matter whatever kind of person has practiced before, whatever in the past or the future, or feels now, painful, racking, piercing feeling due to striving, it can equal this that I'm experiencing, but can't exceed it. If you exceeded it, you would die. But this has this grueling penance. I've attained no distinction higher than the human state, worthy of the noble one's knowledge and vision. Might there be another way to enlightenment? So you kind of learn through failure. You learn through his pushing and pushing that path wasn't working. And he reflected when he was young, when his father was working, and he was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desire, secluded from unwholesome things, and entered upon a deep quality meditation, a sense of balance of attention. This is the middle way that he realized was actually the way to awakening, the way to practice. So as I hear that, you know, my own tendencies to strive, to push, to discount my body, it inspires me to realize, okay, those don't work. At the same time, I also have to have a sense of renunciation, a sense of being willing to really bring energy to the practice, but finding that place of balance. Another really helpful touch point in his life is when he started to develop concentration practices. So he went to two different meditation masters and really studied their teachings to such a depth. They said, okay, you should actually sit next to me and teach alongside of me. You've mastered this. And the Buddha realized that this state of mindfulness or of concentration, even though it's so sublime, so beautiful, so blissful, it still wasn't what I was looking for. It wasn't the sense of awakening. It was conditional. It would come and go. Another sutta. He is talking to a group of monastics, and my sense is that they were kind of really getting into these kind of really sublime states, and how these states would lead to beautiful and more profound rebirths. And he would say, yeah, it's true. It's true that would happen. That these states, this is going to lead to this beautiful state that will last for this long, and then a deeper state will last for even longer. But the end of each of those states, he said, those two are dukkha. Those two are impermanent. And at the end of that sutta, I think it's one of the only suttas that usually at the end of the sutta, they always say something like, and everyone rejoiced at his words. But this one, they actually said that the monks did not rejoice at his words. It's like he's throwing water on their faces, like you're going the wrong direction. You're seeking something which is impermanent. That's not my teachings. And so that also helps as I, with my own practice, when there's those sublime states, they have such a draw to them. There's such a seduction that, oh, if I can just get to that state. But realizing it's not so much about the states, but much more about the insights. And realizing that the insight, the deep insight into the nature of reality, the nature of self, the nature of impermanence, the nature of dukkha, that's really the path. That's really what the Buddha developed. And we think about if he had just said, okay, I'm going to stop here at these great, beautiful states, we probably wouldn't be sitting here 2,600 years ago. It'd be like, or later, it'd be just like, oh, that was a nice experience. But it wouldn't have that lasting quality of transformation. That transformation that transcends the conditions. And that's such a key piece, that so much of our happiness is based on the conditions of our life. If it's this way, I'm happy. If it's not that way, I'm unhappy. The Buddha said that in itself is, he wasn't satisfied with that answer. Because he actually had it made, right? He was like Amazon Prime before he even existed. Anything he wanted, he would get not only next day delivery, the same day delivery would just be like given to him right away, right? So why would he go? Why would he leave that beautiful situation? Because he realized, he was shocked to realize this is impermanent. This is not going to last. That this body is also subject to getting sick, to aging, and to death. That shocked him to his core. So these touch points, yeah, they're realizing that pleasure seeking alone is not going to do it. Pain is not going to do it. Insight, understanding is what's going to do it. And the first words he said when he awoke it, you know, the Buddha means the awakened one. The very first words he said, it's interesting because he didn't talk about, well, this is just such a sublime state. This is so magical. It's so like God consciousness or whatever you want to say it is. He actually said this. Okay, through the round of many births I roamed without reward, without rest, seeking the house builder. Painful was birth again and again. House builder, you're seen. You will not build a house again. All your rafters are broken. The ridgepole is destroyed. Gone to the unformed, the mind has come to the end of craving. And this is said to be the first words he uttered after his awakening. He wasn't proclaiming some sublime state. He wasn't proclaiming some magical or very blissful mind state. He was proclaiming the clarity of seeing the nature of self, that sense of isolation, and the quality of house builder that just kept rebuilding it, you know, through many lifetimes. And we see that in our own lives, and even from day to day, even from moment to moment, how we have, most of us have this house builder that just keeps reforming the sense of self. And we take it as being permanent, unchanging, lasting. And the Buddha said that is what causes suffering. That is the cause of the suffering. So this deep insight still echoes today. It still echoes throughout the way we practice meditation, the way we teach the Dharma. It's an insight that is there for us to realize, to understand. Another interesting and very, especially for today, is the decision for him to teach. Because his first inclination was not to teach, actually. He's like, I think I'm just going to hang out here and be, just enjoy this deep sense of abiding. You know, enough now with teaching. What only with difficulty I reached. This Dhamma is not easily realized by those overcome with aversion and passion. What is abstruse, subtle, deep, hard to see, going against the flow, those delighting in passion, cloaked in the mask of darkness, won't see. Right? So when he reflected on that, he said, I'm not really inclined to teach. I don't really want to teach. So imagine if he had made that decision. Again, we would, I don't know what we'd be doing, something else.
I would even
want to
think about that too.
Yeah. We would never have met. We probably nothing would have come together here. But then a Brahmin sensed this and came to the Buddha and just really said, he thought the world is lost. The Buddha's thinking about not teaching. The world is destroyed. He's inclined to dwell in ease, not to teach the Dhamma. So he arrived and convinced the Buddha. He said, please teach the Dhamma. Please teach it. And so the Buddha heard that invitation, and then he was able to sense there's actually people who would be ripe. The line that I love is that there's people with not much dust in their eyes. They would be able to teach, able to see it, to understand. And so that inspired him to actually take that step to teach. And if you look at the early teachings, you know, it took him a little while to find out how to reach people. That his first is... The first group of people he started to teach, they kind of ignored him for a while. Excuse me. right, until he finally was able to reach them, to help them understand the nature of his practice. It's that season of pollen for my old throat. So once he decided to teach, the next piece that I really resonate with is this phrase, ikipaso, to actually see, come see for yourself, to actually see in your own experience. And this is such a, especially in our culture and how religion is often presented, it's like instead of having an external authority saying, believe this, just take my word for it, it's actually look at this direction. This is a helpful place to look. And don't take my word for it. Actually see it in the landscape of your own mind, your own body. See the consequences of your actions, the way you think, the way you speak, the way you think. You know, all those ways, see how that feedback is. And by doing so, you'd start to develop this incredible confidence in the practice. There's often a phrase you see that when after the Buddha said something that really moved someone, that really brought a quality of inspiration, they would say, magnificent, Lord, magnificent. Just as if he were to place upright what was overturned, to reveal what was hidden, to show the way to one who was lost, or to carry a lamp into the dark so that those with eyes could see forms. In the same way, the Blessed One, through many lines of reasoning, made the Dhamma clear. I go to the Blessed One for refuge, to the Dhamma, and to the community of practitioners. May the Blessed One remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge from this day forward for life. So this sense of seeing for yourself and that delight in that. And one of the most important things to see for yourself is this nature of self, this nature of who we take ourselves to be. There's a beautiful sutta when it's called Turuhula, his son actually. And Turuhula had been practicing for a while and had really deepened in his practice, and the Buddha sensed he was ripe to really open in this way. So he sat down with the Buddha and they maybe took a walk. And he just started to ask Rahula questions. He said something as simple as, what do you think, Rahula? Is the eye constant or inconstant? Right? Does what you see always the same, or is it fluxing? Is it changing? And Rahula said, inconsistent, Lord. And that which is inconsistent, is it easy or stressful? Is it easy or stressful? It is stressful. Because that's kind of pointing toward dukkha, that sense of things are unsubstantiality. And is it fitting to regard that which is inconsistent, stressful, subject to change, as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? So the Buddha is saying the nature of what you are has to be outside of what's changing, has to be outside of what's stressful. That's kind of a really profound statement to take in. Because so many of us have this really deep sense of self-dislike, self-hatred. It's so heavy. But the Buddha is saying that should not be, you should not take that as yourself. That should be not what you take as who you are. And then, of course, the famous sutta to Bahia, who is this character who got shipwrecked and landed on this island or somewhere on the shore and didn't have any clothes. All his clothes got ripped off by the waves. So he grabbed a bunch of bark to cover himself up. The villagers thought, well, here's this really dedicated practitioner, this Brahmin. We're going to start to worship him and give him food. And he thought, this is kind of cool. Everyone's liking me. They're really kind of bowing down to me. And then, he thought, maybe I am enlightened. Maybe I've got it because they're treating me like I am. But he had a relative who was a diva. Diva came in and said, no, actually, you have no idea. You're not going that way at all. You've come completely wrong. And to his credit, he was really shocked by that. And he really wanted to awaken. So he said, who can I ask? Go to ask the Buddha. So he travels right then and there, travels a long distance, finally get to the Buddha. The Buddha is about to go on alms trail and around, doesn't really want to talk to him, but he just really is insistent. And so finally, he just gives it, the Buddha gives it to the teaching so directly that then Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. And that is how you should train yourself. Okay, so here, this is the deeper piece of it. For you, there's will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized. Then, Bahia, there's no you in connection with that. When there's no you in connection with that, there's no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. And it's not like Bahia vanished. It was the insight of non-self, of the clarity of seeing through that illusion of separation. And in that seeing, his heart awakened, his heart opened. And this is, you know, for me, this is some of the biggest gifts that the Buddha continues to give my life, to give us as practitioners on this path. So today we honor the Buddha for all his wisdom, all his courage, all his clarity, his willingness to step with where the insights are, to hold true to really what is awakening. And I thank him for that.
Yeah, this is a really special day. I like the fact that this day is being celebrated by millions of Buddhists all over the world, yesterday and today, depending where you are located in the world. I think some people actually celebrated it earlier, but the official days are 22nd, 23rd. And I think what I wanted to talk about is the inspiration of the Buddha. So there's two things about the Buddha himself. One is his life and stuff he did that Tim's talking about, all the different stories, these choice points that he had in his life to choose in the direction that he went. And ultimately, what made him so unique is that he could not only find his way into awakening, but then tell someone else. And when he could tell someone else, it's like he turned the wheel of Dhamma, because now anyone in this room can awaken by following the path that he set out. And that, it's very difficult to actually come up with the words that articulate how someone else can awaken. So there's another side to his life also, and it is the refuge side, the part of his life that actually provides protection, which is a little different. And I never really thought about refuge. Taking refuge, I mean, I took refuge in the Buddha all the time for retreats, but I didn't really grasp what it meant to take refuge until a few years ago, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, was in Vancouver. And me and some friends went down, and we looked up and got these nuns' tickets that the nuns here in Seattle had too many. And they had four extra ones, and we got those. So we were something like 30 seats from the stage. I was like stunned in this Coliseum that had something like 50, 60,000 seats. And we're sitting in this room that's packed, listening to His Holiness. And at some point, he took questions, and it seemed like every question was, what are you going to do about China and Tibet? I mean, shouldn't nonviolence doesn't really work. I mean, China's getting further and further into Tibet. What are you going to do about it? And he would just keep responding in this gentle way. We just keep practicing. We just keep practicing. And you could tell that people were not liking that answer. So I guess they thought they'd get a different answer if they asked it a different way. So they'd ask, the next person would ask a similar question. And so finally, he just told everyone to just stop and to close their eyes. And he said, started asking us to think about our childhood and what we grew up with. And he pointed out some things. Think about, your family. Think about your parents, good or bad. Think about the good stuff in your childhood, the bad stuff in your childhood. And he kept making these little pointing references of things to think about. And he probably did it for like maybe 20 minutes. And then he said we could open our eyes. And he said to look around the room. We looked around the room. It's like all these people. And he goes, so Tibet was a closed society. And when I was born in Tibet, there was no way we were leaving outside of Tibet because all of our teaching had this fear that we were going to be put through a huge test. So Tibet was closed to foreigners and he could not leave. Had it not been for the Chinese, he would not be here. So he needs to like look around. If it were not for the Chinese, none of us would be here. And I just had this moment when I realized that because of the Buddha's willingness to teach, this choice that he made to teach, I didn't even know this man. I don't know anything about him, but because of a choice that he made some 2,700, 2,600 years ago, I was sitting in a foreign country. I mean, I grew up in the projects in High Point. I'm sitting in a foreign country listening to a foreign man about the Dhamma. And all of that, it just all seemed to, like the past, the present, and the future all came together at one moment. And I had this profound realization that the Buddha didn't teach me how to get through my life. He actually taught me how to stay in my life, to be in my life and live it. And before my coming into the Dhamma, I was always trying to run away from everything that was happening, trying to fix everything so that it could be the way I wanted, not the way life just was. And that realization in that moment was a life, it was a game changer for me to begin to see that I was actually living in my life. So what I am pointing to is that Buddha put a twist on our normal thinking about refuge. When we normally think about taking refuge, we think about it in terms of having something outside of us protect us from the outside difficulties. And he put a twist because he pointed towards like protecting from our own minds, that we needed a shelter. The danger that was in our lives was not out there, it was internal. And that we needed a protection to from the danger of greed, hatred, and delusion. So basically, when he went through all of that blissfulness that Tim was talking about, it wasn't really helping him transcend any of the difficulties of being a human being. He was still the same human being, subject to the same thing that caused him to leave in the first place. And even when he spent all that time in the pain and misery, of beating up the body fiercely. He just sat there in a lot of pain and a lot of suffering, and he was nowhere near being close to being outside of this human body. So in his understanding, when he came to the path, that path was a way to transcend through whatever was the truth about being human, and learn to take shelter in our own capacity to be with whatever is arising. And that capacity grows the more you be with what is arising. So Tim was talking about the external Buddha, Siddhartha, the man, and there is an internal called Buddha nature. Sometimes it's called that. It's our capacity to awaken. And if you hold the Buddha as a person, a human being, just like you and me, then you can begin to see your own capacity for awakening. If you hold him as being somehow godlike, then you'll think, oh, this is somebody that had special birth, but it's not like me. He didn't grow up in my mess, because if he grew up in my mess, he wouldn't be awakened. But it's even though he had all of this refinement as a child, whatever pain you go through, that's what he went through in his process when he became a monk and started practicing. He went through the joys and the pains of existence. But another way, Ajahn Sumedho said something about the Buddha that I have, ever since I heard it when he was here, I think it was a couple years ago, ever since he said that, I've never forgotten it. He said that you could consider the Buddha as mindfulness. And the way that you think of it as mindfulness as the Buddha is that when you establish mindfulness, when you learn to practice and establish a sense of steadying your mind, you are in effect bringing the Buddha within you. You're growing this capacity to awaken the Buddha that's in us. You're growing that in your own capacity. And so this establishment of mindfulness becomes one of the it's one of the foundations for being able to stay in your life, to learn how to shield yourself from the dangers of your own mind's greed, hatred, and delusion. In Buddhist time, you read the suttas, there were a lot of people like in our time. It isn't like he lived in a time when there was no drama. He lived in a time where there were all these teachers out there having their own way of looking at things, all these religious leaders, great people, all these politicians, philosophers, you name it. He had the same, and there was so much noise as to how you should be, how you should be. And people would forever come to the Buddha and ask him, well, so-and-so says this, what do you say? And he would not say anything. And they'd say, well, okay, do you believe in this? Do you believe in this? And they would ask him all these questions about this constant views and opinions that were in the world, and he wouldn't respond. And there's something significant about what he did. I'll give you my paraphrasing. I don't think he cared what people's opinion was. I don't think he cared if this teacher thought that or that teacher thought that. He didn't care about all the opinions that exist and the possibility of opinions that exist in the world. He cared about one thing. Do you know that dukkha is present. Do you know the origin of that dukkha? Do you know the cessation of that dukkha? And then do you know the path that leads to the cessation of dukkha? Because anything beyond the direct understanding of that is all opinion, and it's all subject to change depending on what your life is like. I mean, I cannot believe the changes in my views on all kinds of things over the years. I've had lots of changes in my views, but ultimately, all of that comes and goes. But my understanding of dukkha, the investigation of it, the willingness to see it, the willingness to see and understand where it's coming from, the willingness to see that clinging, the grasping, the whole thing that's happening with me, and the willingness to sort of see its cessation, that never changes. It's always consistently constant. The various types of dukkha changes. I mean, I didn't really think of dukkha as being pleasurable things so much years ago, you know, but now I can even see how the pleasurable things can become dukkha if I get too caught up in it. So in this way, this was his middle way. He was not caught up in the extremes of opinions and thoughts. It's okay, this idea that people have all this diverse opinion and thought. What his middle way was, being in the direct experience of where you are and beginning to understand how this experience is affecting you, impacting you in this moment. So the way that we come into this present moment direct experience is through meditation, this process of learning to steady our attention, to watch what's happening. That's what it is that he did in this decision. I mean, when he was dying and he had that vision of his childhood, he had to actually come to an understanding. He had to steady his attention. So he had to get his strength back. He had to go against everything he believed in just to get his health back and steady his attention. And ultimately, that's what he did. He learned to steady his attention on whatever was happening, to begin to know for himself what was going on. The thing that I think is so significant about the Buddha's practice is that it doesn't rely on a specific technique, right? So we learn all these different meditations. You can learn it from Mahasi has a meditation, Upandita has a meditation. You can learn it from Goenka has a meditation style, Utejan Nia, Ajahn Chah had his own style. So you can say, oh, I do the Burmese style, or oh, I do Thai forest style. There's all these different styles of meditation to help steady your attention. But ultimately, when you are in meditation, your own internal desire to want to begin to see and understand what's happening, that is what guides your path. That's what he did. He became guided by his own wanting to know. So when we celebrate Vesak, what we're celebrating is that in Buddhism, this idea that death and birth and phenomena that happens throughout our lives is all different things. But in Buddhism, it's all one thing. So his death is simultaneous with his birth. That at the moment of his enlightenment, everything came together. Birth and death came together in this understanding. It's what happened to me when I was in Vancouver. This understanding, this recognition that none of my past, even the bad stuff, because some of you know I grew up in trauma, crazy house, but even that was necessary for me to be in that moment with this holiness in Canada. The realization that that moment was also so inspiring that it was going to carry me into the future, that I knew in that moment my entire life had changed just from listening to this man. So there's a way in which the Buddha's, what he did, created in this moment both his birth 2,700 years later in Seattle, Washington, in this little church, we're all kind of like here together. And his awakening is all simultaneously here in this moment. So the ceremony we're celebrating is not kind of like a, I mean, Vesak sometimes is compared to the Christian Christmas and Easter. It's not so much this worshiping of Buddha as much as it is this recognition that we would not be here but for him in this configuration. And we would not, and whatever we do in this moment, in this evening, whatever energies we send out in the world will impact generations that we don't even see. So our practice, no matter what your state of practice is impacting future generations. That millions of practitioners impacted our practice. Can you see how this is all so intersected that we're celebrating the reality that past and the future and the present are all one in this moment in time? And there's no separation between it. And there's no separation in Buddha's life. His awakening, his death, and his birth are all intertwined together. So with that, I want to tell you a little bit about the ceremony we're going to do, and I want to give the people online a time. If you want to participate in it, you can just sit with us and listen to the music I'm going to play and be a part of it. But you can also get some water, get a candle if you have one. If you don't have any flowers, just, you know, we're going to be sharing our flower energy with you. But you need a candle, a water, a Buddha statue if you have one, and a candle. Candle, water, and a Buddha statue. So I want to give you, there's all kinds of explanations as to what these items represent. So I want to give you three different versions of what it represents, why we do it. So on one hand, the flowers represent earth. The water, water. The flame of the candle is fire. And we say metta and prayers when we go over to the candle. So when we go over to the actual altar area where I set it up over there, we say prayers, and the prayers are sent off in the wind, just to be carried on the wind. And so that this represents the four elements and the Buddha's transformation of the four elements. And so whenever you go to Vesak ceremonies, there's flowers, there's candles, there's water, and there's this pouring of water that happens. Another way I've heard it described is that the flowers represent impermanence, the impermanent nature of the way it this exists, and that the candle represents sort of the emptiness, the flame. It's both empty. It's like light. We are all light beings, and not necessarily me and you, but we're all light beings, and there's all light energy all in the world, but we can't see it like that because we see so much form. And then as we uncover this kind of wisdom eye of what the Buddha was pointing to with Bahia, we can begin to see that we are all of the same substance. We are all light beings. We are all stardust. And so the candle represents that light, and then the water represents the the candle, the light of the candle represents non-self, and the water and the flowing nature of it, the changing nature of it, represents the subject to change of dukkha. So it's like the three characteristics bundled up in this one moment. And then one more way of thinking about it is that the candle represents this light. It's the light that the Buddha kind of brought into the world to show what's actually going on, so we can see things as they actually are and not get caught so much in our opinions. The flowers represent how fleeting life is. It's not just that it's impermanent, but it's fleeting. Flowers do not last very long at all. And there's a fleetingness to it. So it creates this sense of urgency to stay in the practice and to be together as a Sangha, to encourage each other to stay in the practice. And then the water represents this capacity, the practice's capacity to purify our life. And it purifies through the pouring of it. And so the way we're going to do this is I'm going to play some music, because music helps us get inspired. And so I'm going to play some music, and then each of us can get up at some point and walk over to the Buddha and pour. There's a ladle there, so you just take the ladle and get some water and pour it over the Buddha. It's in that pouring that we're actually trying to purify. And then we say metta. So you could say, you know, may all beings be free from suffering. It could be more personal. May I be free from suffering. It could be someone you care about. May so-and-so be free from suffering. But you say your metta, and then you, for the freedom from suffering, and then offer a degree of support. And may our practice this evening be of support to Sims, be of support to you in your life, be of support to so-and-so, whatever it is. So this kind of the freedom from suffering, and then the second one is the merit of our practice. Can we send it out into the world? And so two dips, or more if you want, but we can take our own time. There's no rush. Let me just check online. Do you guys need time to get some water and things, or are you good? You're good? Okay, so we'll just sit here with the music then. And yeah, we'll just be quiet for a little bit. We'll start playing, and then whoever's ready can get up and go over and do your pouring. And when we've all done, then we'll stop. Okay? All right. The first song I want to play is sung by Melanie Damore,
was wrote by Melanie DeBoer and sung.
Oh, you got to turn this on.
Or it's still on, isn't it?
I don't know.
It's maybe closer.
Is it on? Oh, yeah. Okay. So the first song is written and sung by Melanie DeBoer. And Julie Wolfe is playing the piano. And I'm giving you a little bit of an explanation because you could think of this song as your practice, Melanie's words, as your practice, what your practice is doing. It's helping you send your own body and life light, or you could see that Melanie's words are the body or the practice telling you it's sending you light. Either way. But this is her song about our relationship with this embodied practice. So let's find it here.
No matter what you feel,
I better start at the beginning.
I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. No matter where you go, no matter where you've been, you'll never walk alone. I feel you deep within. So I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. No matter what you feel or what you choose to show, I'm always there for you. And so I want you to know that I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you. I walk the path with you. Go slow, dear one, don't hurry. I'll go just like you need to go. There is no need to worry. 'Cause I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love. I am sending you light to heal you, to hold you. I am sending you light to hold you in love.
This next chant says Ra Ma Da Sa, which means sun, moon, earth, infinity. Sa Se So Hung, which means all that is infinity, I am thee. Or the totality of everything merges into me.
Thank you.
This next one, Hum Me Hum, is The Other Is You.
Bye.
So I want to thank everyone for participating in our ceremony. It's a little bit after our time, but take some time today and the rest of the year. Vesak is often celebrated for the whole month of May every year. But it changes depending on the moon, the actual day. So take some time this month, for the rest of the month and the time that's here, and think about or come to an understanding of what the Buddha's life is actually for you, individually. What is it that impacts you about the Buddha? More than just how it's fixed your life, you know. I mean, everybody here online and in this room can say, oh, I'm way better. But what is it that he brought because of his life? What is it that brought into your life something? What is, and then becoming to terms with what that is. And then maybe having a sense of gratitude for the rest of the month, maybe every day before you go to bed, think of something that you're grateful for and tie it to this understanding of the Buddha's life. So that you're not just practicing to fix something, you're not practicing because you think you have to out of some obligation, that you're actually practicing in this inspired truth that's connecting you, his awakening to your awakening. And we are all tied together in that, in this journey or this path towards awakening. Right? That's what this is about. So I hope you enjoyed this evening. This time next year, we will be in our own space doing this, which will be much better. But I'm just grateful that we came together and that we did this. And I hope it was as moving for you as it was for me. So I'll see you again next year. Thank you so much. Want to say anything?
Yeah, thank you so much for participating in this ceremony. It's just lovely to watch everyone come up at their own pace, their own way of offering their connection with the Buddha. And as we wrap up tonight, if those are in person, if you like to see the new space, you can go down and take a look at it. And if you also have a hand to give us, bring some cushions downstairs, that would be great. And the Donna basket's over there if you'd like to offer Donna. Thank you so much for those, everyone in person and online. Be well.
Thank you. See you.